Hello everybody and welcome to another episode. In this episode we're going to talk about open source business models. I'm Mark Clark, I'm from South Africa where I work for an open source solutions company and we basically develop customized solutions for our various customers' needs and requirements. I'm joined today by Darlene Parker from Canada. Hi Darlene, how are you?
I'm very well, Mark. Thanks for having me today. So I work for a company as well that works with Linux-based solutions. And here in Canada, but we have a clientele around the globe. And I found that this topic today was particularly interesting to me because we straddle the fence on both sides of this topic. And let's see what we can share with our listeners today, Mark.
I think we should begin by first saying that, you know, this more is a podcast designed to get debate going and to get people thinking about these kind of topics. I don't know what the answers are for them. I've got some thoughts around it, and it's in a state of flux. So when I get new information, it gets modified and changed. Because I think, you know, how to make money out of open source or how to run a business that's based on open source is something which a lot of people in the world are struggling with. You know, from whether they're large commercial companies that are on a closed source model and they're considering open source, or whether you're a company like the one I work for here in South Africa, we already use open source and you're selling services on top of that. I think we should begin by defining what we mean by open source. Because you can have open source code but still have a proprietary closed source model where no one can contribute back. You know, kind of like the Microsoft shared source model. So what we mean by open source is basically the definitions that's been defined by the Open Source Initiative. You know, it's very similar to the definition in the GNU Public License by Richard Stallman. And essentially, that means that the software's source code is freely available. People are free to use it. They're free to modify it. And if anybody modifies it and distributes it, then they must distribute the modified source code along with it. I know there's a bit of a philosophical difference between Richard Stallman and the Open Source Initiative about open source, because Richard Stallman has a social aspect, you know, he sees a social aspect, which I can also identify with, to open source software in the sense of contributing to the development of technologies and economies and basically, you know, making life in general better for humanity. And whereas the Open Source Initiative, some people kind of describe it as more of a software development model rather than sort of a philosophical model with social aspects to it. I don't know whether you have anything to add to that definition or clarification points there, Darlene.
Well, I think that as we move through the open source models, like, so I think it is both, Mark. Like you talked about, you know, being software production, producing a software product in the end that everybody can contribute to. But on the other hand, as I work with countries around the world, the adoption of open source has opened up the window or bridged that digital divide for so many people that previously couldn't. Like even with the use of, you know, pirated Microsoft licensing and all of this, it's still was a barrier to entry for so many people. So I believe that there is still a social aspect to what we do in the open source community.
Yeah, I agree 100%. And that's what I think attracts most people to open source or open source hackers. You know, get attracted by this whole idea of the, you know, contributing to something bigger than yourselves and basically enabling the development and betterment of whole economies, I mean, the world in general. You know, one of the aspects of open source that this kind of addresses is very similar to the way PCs or the PC industry developed. Look at IBM, for example. When they produced the PC, they could have kept it closed. But what they did is open the specifications. And as a result, today we have a whole, you know, ecosystem around supporting PCs and the open standards around PCs. So you don't have a manufacturer somewhere in Taiwan saying, look, I'm going to produce the motherboard with this new bus architecture and only my, you know, peripheral devices are run on this bus and no one else can use it. You know, everybody gets together, they decide on a new standard for the bus architecture, and everybody's free to develop hardware peripherals or components to run on those buses. And that's a very similar kind of approach that open source takes. I mean, if you took a more closed source of proprietary approach to it, you would be in a situation like the cell phone market is today, where it's just fragmented. There's so many different platforms. There's no consistency between them all that they actually fail to realize all the benefits that, you know, that the mobile cell phone market could actually have. You know, you always keep on reading these predictions about how the, you know, if you had the killer app on the cell phones, how it would take over the world and how it can change the lives of people in rural areas, etc., and that kind of stuff. But the reality is, because it's so fragmented and it's not based on a kind of open standard and a cooperative approach to it, and it's very proprietary, it just doesn't deliver those promised benefits. And that's what I think is, you know, really is a social aspect for me around open source development. And it's a very compelling argument, you know, just to consider the sort of, so as they call it, the philanthropic side of the whole thing, you know. And then it's just how you build a business model on top of that.
Right. It's like, I know for me, I think the other benefits is with open source. And like I say, I have a mixed approach to this topic today, but is that whether I'm talking to someone who's trying to add an indigenous language in Bolivia or trying to put together an educational program in Pakistan, because of course the code is so open, like they can modify it to their particular needs and engage those young bright minds to help them come to a solution. So I think that's the other side of open source that I particularly like.
Look, I've probably done a hatchet job on the definition of open source here. I'm sure there's a lot of advocates out there of open source who are probably shouting into their headphones now. But I think, you know, that's just a working definition. I don't claim to be an expert or a lawyer in how to define it, but that's how I understand it. And I think to a large degree, you know, what I'm saying, most people will kind of follow along with that kind of definition around open source. Would you agree with that, Darlene? Or?
No, I agree with your, you know, that's just an overview. And like you said earlier, that's just our point of view. And yes, people can have different interpretations and we can go a lot deeper into the layers. But I think in general, when you mention open source to someone, the definition that you provided, Mark, is a pretty well understood one.
And I just want to say, look, I mean, in this podcast, we're not trying to argue that open source is not a good way of developing things. We definitely feel it's a much better development model than the closed source or proprietary way of developing software. I mean, definitely open source results in better quality software, you know, because much more user interaction and user involvement in the whole development process, and it results in sort of quicker development of your products and of better software. So just to sort of let people know that, you know, we're not trying to, if we say something which sounds negative, it's within the context of trying to better further understanding open source and how to use it in the business context, rather than sort of trying to compare it to the closed source model, which we just dismiss out of hand.
Right. The basic question is, how do you make money on an open source product? Because here in North America, you know, we have a very profit-driven philosophies here. And, you know, when I discuss this with people who maybe aren't even in open source, like totally removed, it's business people in general, the question and answer is basically, if I gave you a free product, then what? Then how do I compensate myself for my development time? How do I compensate myself for how do I get the product out there? I have to put it on a website somewhere. Who pays for the website? Who pays for the services? Who pays? How do I get it started? And then I think today we're going to talk about, you know, maybe the stuff that comes around that product. You know, what do you think of that, Mark?
Yeah, look, I agree with you. Unfortunately, the current system in which we live, the only motive is a profit motive, and that's how things are. You know, that's the rules of the game that we play. And I do agree there are other aspects that people should probably consider and be part of the whole plan, the whole goals of a business. But you know, that's another debate. But the current sort of game plan, you know, it is a problem if you know, how do you actually make money out of an open source product, okay? And I think this is the core of the topic that you want to discuss, as you said. You know, and I think there are a couple of models out there, and the most typical model that people bring up when you mention open source is, oh, well, you open source the product, and then you sell training, consulting, and or support on top of that, okay? And that seems like a very, you know, a lot of guys get excited and say, oh, that makes a whole lot of sense. If you're a small company sitting somewhere, you know, like let's say you guys in Alberta, Canada, you release a product, you want to get a big market share and you want to start selling service on top of it, one of the easiest ways to do it is to open source it. And then a lot of people around the world will start using it and trading up on their product. And obviously one of the benefits from that is then people then start looking for support when they hit issues which they can't solve themselves, or training. And I think most people sort of stop and leave that business model at that point, you know. But I'll go so far as saying there's very few companies that just use that approach to making money out of open source and the open source development model.
Well, I think, Mark, that they also I think they have a staggered approach, like a dual approach to it, where they give us a free open source product that we can get used to and work with. And then all of a sudden we say, hey, you know, that's a good product, but I'm going to bring it into a bigger enterprise. And then you'll look at the enterprise version of their product and perhaps pay for that, because they've already got us liking it. They've got our mind share on the product. It was like VirtualBox or, I don't know. I'm not sure if Asterix has a higher level that you can buy as well. But, you know, I started working with VirtualBox, and I really like it. And I know they have different levels of, you know, I can buy a full version, per se.
You know, the different approaches to use it to open source in your business is how you use it. So some companies, for example, use open source merely to sell other products that they have. Okay? So essentially, it's making it easier to sell the existing product. And I think those are the most successful open source companies around today. And if you look at them, they're all the big players. And they're typically proprietary vendors that are using open source in some way. So, for example, like Linux and IBM. Oracle and IBM. So Oracle, for example, IBM, they're only interested in supporting Linux because it makes it easier for them to sell their database products on top of it. You're not going to find IBM or Oracle, for example, open sourcing their database products, because that's where they make their money. And I think that's quite an easy business model to understand. If you had to explain that to a business person, they would get it and understand it. I mean, just like, you know, people sort of sell, they'll give the premise stoves away for free in the third world countries. But then, of course, the people that have the premise stoves need to come and buy the gas or the paraffin to run those stoves from you. So, you know, you're making money out of selling the fuel to run that. So it's a very similar thing that a lot of these large corporates are doing. You know, then another approach, the one you're talking about, is where basically the software that you're open sourcing is core to your business. It's where you really make your money. Okay, a good example of that is all like Asterix that you mentioned, MySQL, or even Red Hat, for example. Yeah, and I think that is where you start finding it. There's a lot of different models around how you make money out of open source. So Asterix, for example, makes money from selling the hardware components on top of that. And, for example, a lot of other companies will make money by selling dual licenses. So they have an open source license. And there's no difference between the open source and the closed source product. But if you want to sort of use it in a commercial product, you don't want to have to release your commercial product as an open source project, then you would buy a license from the providers. So, I mean, I know Qt, the guys from the widget set that's used in KDE, they had a model like that until recently. And I think that works quite well because, you know, what you're basically saying is you're allowing all the people, all the developers throughout the world to use your product, to get skilled up in it, which then provides its support for your product in commercial environments. So they'll know there's a whole bunch of developers out there that already know how to use this product and that kind of thing. And of course, the last one is this sort of light commercial version that you talk about. Personally, I don't like that model because it's sort of like a, how can you call it, almost like a bait and switch, or, you know, you hook the guy in and then sooner or later you're forced to move up to the commercial version. But I know that is quite widely supported by a lot of open source projects such as Indian Firewall. Yeah, and I can't remember some other products, but definitely Indian Firewall uses that approach to its product.
Right, and I personally believe that the value of the software lies in the value-added services that go around it. Let's go back to Asterix. Mm-hmm. So we talk about Asterix. So some guy wants to download a free version of Asterix, but he needs somebody to help him integrate it into his system and get his phone lines all working and all his voicemails, and that's where people like yourself come in, who can do those kind of services for them and then teach their staff how to, you know, add those extra extensions and so on afterwards. But, you know, so when we were talking about, you know, giving out that little bit of tantalizer at the beginning, it's like a lost leader where you give away some open source product and then position them to come in and buy your closed source. I know that my company does that in a indirect way, and in that we give away a free 2-user license that you can use, you know, to test it. You can use it at home. You can try it out. But if you need any more than 2 stations, their product, then you have to contact us for, you know, to purchase the code.
You know, I'd agree. I think if I look at the sort of ones where the software is core to the business, you know, there's very few open source companies that are successful in this field without somehow restricting access to certain aspects of their product. You know, if you look at companies where the commercial version, or not the supported version, where they just sold pure support on top of it, the version that people could download and use was exactly the same as the version that the enterprise would use, for example, like MySQL. You know, basically they couldn't make money out of it. And MySQL eventually got bought by Sun, you know, Sun also sort of appears to fail to have made money out of open source because they got bought out recently by Oracle. So I think a lot of these companies that they're trying to have a pure open source, although it's very admirable, you know, they're trying a pure open source approach with the entire code base is open, do end up with problems. I mean, if you take Asterix, for example, and this is one distinction I want to draw. Asterix and the kind of business model that we're in, it's great for us because I can make money out of selling servers on top of Asterix. But how does Asterix or Digim, the company that's responsible for Asterix, make money out of it? And that's the difficult part because, you know, currently mm-hmm. they're making out of hardware. But, I mean, the hardware is also sort of open. So you find a whole lot of guys in China now are manufacturing hardware that's compatible with Asterix and they can use new Asterix boxes and stuff. And that's going to eat into Asterix's revenue. So those guys have, right. you know, have a hard time sort of making money on it unless there's something behind it. You know, one of the things that people tend to do, they tend to set up these like partnership or reseller programs because there's definitely the larger businesses do like to know that they've got some corporate that they can hold responsible if their you know, application doesn't work properly. And so you find a lot of these guys, for example, that's what Red Hat model is based on, you know, where they'll buy support from Red Hat or from Asterix directly. But you know, all that requires is some bigger competitor or somebody that's also well established in the business to come and also offer the same services. And I mean, we've seen that happen with Red Hat, for example. So now we've got old Oracle offering support for Red Hat. Yeah, and that I've checked Red Hat a lot, and the fact of the matter is that there's not much, you know, Red Hat can do about it. They might say nasty things about Oracle, but that is one of the problems with the open source model if it's completely open sourced. You know, and I think Red Hat, a lot of guys will see as one of the most successful, and they are one of the most successful sort of open source vendors out there. But they definitely have they don't provide the entire stack, as it were, to an open source model. So what you find, like Fedora, I mean, Fedora mm-hmm. essentially is the experimental version of their product. So they're using the open source community to get some value back to Red Hat by providing basically beta testers. I know a lot of guys go and they deploy Fedora on their servers. Why? I do not know, because it's unstable. But, you know, a lot of people do that, and they provide valuable feedback to Red Hat to enhance their enterprise product. And even within the enterprise product, although you can use CentOS, there are components which, you know, like management components and tools and stuff, which aren't open source. They do tend to open source them over time, but, you know, they keep a lot back so that there's some value, for example, for a corporate to go and buy services from Red Hat. I think that's what's key. You know, if I look across the open source business out there, the successful ones, what is key to their success is that something of value has to be held back to make the customer come through and buy support from you. Because if you're just providing support that anybody else can provide, you know, there's a danger that it's very easy for a competitor to come into your space and sort of eat your lunch.
Right. And back to what you said about, you know, people trying Fedora and it's kind of that front leader and then they'll upgrade from there. I feel that once you start down the Linux path, you tend to stay with one or two distros that you really know well and then look at products that work around those, because you kind of get a loyalty, a little mind share happening there. And, like, you know, and we talked briefly about Photoshop at one point. Mm-hmm. You know, if they gave away Photoshop, if they gave away all the code, what value would Photoshop have? Like, for me, the tutorials and all the brushes and stuff that come with it, Photoshop isn't the value. It's the core of the program. But on the other hand, in the industry, graphic design industry, it's kind of the thought is, you know, there's a lot of pirated versions of Adobe out there. And Adobe's not been as strict as, say, Windows to validate your licenses. But then some people say, you know, it's because people get trained up on Adobe Photoshop and stuff, and then when they're students or when they're learning, they go into their business environment. What do you think they're going to encourage them to buy with the full suite of Adobe products?
Look, I mean, the thing, I suppose, Photoshop is one of the classic cases we can use as to where open source models will not work, you know, as far as I can tell. Because everybody always, you know, one of the big things that people say when you ask them about why aren't they switching to Linux desktops, it'll be, oh, because, you know, Photoshop isn't open source. And then people always say, why doesn't Adobe open source Photoshop? But as you say, I think if the open source Photoshop, there's no compelling reason for people to come through to Adobe and buy services. Sure, I understand what you're saying about it, training up people using the product so when they get to the work environment, they're really trained and that's a product they'll ask for. But if Adobe took the approach of saying, okay, it's completely open source and free, I mean, basically their revenue will just dry up overnight.
Yeah, and then would they continue to develop new versions and stuff if they had no revenue? How would they pay for that?
Yeah, exactly. You know, so I'm saying something has to be kept going. What they could potentially do is come out with like a light version, or they wanted to release the experimental version, something similar to what Red Hat is doing, you know, and get sort of feedback and testing that way. They might be able to make money out of it. But a sort of way that, you know, like the approach that sort of like MySQL took doesn't seem to work. I mean, you know, MySQL, from what I understand, didn't really make enough money, and that's why they got bought up by Sun. All they could really do was become an expensive lunch. Yeah, I think in some respects, open source will work fine that way if your idea is, okay, we want to gain market share. Yeah, we don't know how we're going to make money out of it. We just want to gain like a large market share and either become like an expensive lunch for an acquisition by a larger corporate, or, you know, or try and work out later how to make money, you know, sort of similar to the Facebook and the Google approach. But that doesn't, you know, so there's no sort of really, to my mind, a sustainable model behind that. I think that's the key thing, you know. Red Hat really has worked out how to sort of make money out of open source, because before they bought in Fedora, I think they were, you know, they were struggling a bit, and since they've done that approach of having an experimental version, which they provide rather than providing their enterprise version free for download, you know, the financial fortunes have changed quite a bit. And recently they bought JBoss. You know, and JBoss is another example of a open source application where the version that you could download was exactly the same as the enterprise version that they provided. And they also never really made a lot of money. Eventually they just got bought out by Red Hat. And now Red Hat is taking the same approach where they're going to have an experimental version available, you know, freely on the project site. But the commercial version, you know, where you buy a subscription or support subscription for it, and that sort of bundles everything together, so the APIs all work, all the different libraries work together. You don't have to spend like hours of time trying to, I'm a Java programmer as well, you know, you might spend hours trying to sort out what version of the Java files you need and what works with what and all of that kind of stuff. Yeah, so that's what they're going to be doing with that. And I think that's the, you know, the only open source model I've seen so far where it's core to your business that actually seems to work.
But on the other side of it, Mark, I also feel that with an open source product, if you open source your code, you can actually reduce your research and development costs and speed up the delivery of your new products, because you have a whole community of people helping you improve your product, beta test it, and so on. If you keep it totally closed source, and at my company, we have chosen to do that. We layer on top of a Linux distro, but we have closed code. So then we only have limited bandwidth in order to bring the new features out and keep our software, you know, on leading edge. But we, like I say, it all relies on the shoulders of two or three developers instead of the whole community. And, like, you know, even because our product is Linux-based, we still have a flavor of that, because when I put it out there, you know, my partners are trying different things and doing different setups with their product. So I think there is that side to it. It is a kind of a paradox, but
I would agree. I think the key thing is, you know, you want to get that sweet spot where you can release enough of it that, you know, you can get people to use it, and a lot of small corporates and individuals, you know, can use it without any restrictions on their use of it. But at the same time, there's something which will sort of compel larger corporates or people who have the money to actually come through to you to get the support. And also, you know, you want to be able to be in a position where they want to get that support from you, and not necessarily from somebody else, you know. I think that's that's a key conundrum for all businesses that are trying to figure out how to use open source, and also use it in a way which isn't like a mercenary way, but which is true to the principles and philosophy behind open source as well, which is what we discussed earlier.
Okay, well, I think, you know, because you mentioned there was companies that had started out with open source, but then they've clearly, you know, they've used open source technology to become very successful. People like Google, PayPal, Amazon, you know, even Yahoo Maps, they were created by open source developers. They run on an open source platform, but they are very proprietary. Their source code is not distributed. And for them, the value is in their data and not just in the code.
They're just using it to get, you know, to get the numbers in terms of the large number of people that go to their sites and make money, revenue off of advertising and that kind of stuff, you know. So, I mean, yeah, those guys, that's another, I suppose, another kind of business model where you're actually just using open source as core to your business. And that I can understand. I mean, we use tons of open source products in our company. I mean, all of our products, well, all of our machines and systems are based on open source products. You know, if we had to pay commercially for those things, we wouldn't be able to afford them. But, you know, because open source, we can. And I think, you know, that enables us to provide services to our customers. So open source, I think definitely you can make money out of it if you're somebody that's using it like we are, to sell services and solutions on top of it. But it's, you know, how do you ensure that the companies actually, because a lot of these open source projects, some of them have corporate sponsors behind them as such, you know, the big successful ones. And how does that big corporate sponsor make money out of the project, you know?
But I think we talk, though, that these big corporate sponsors, there's something in it for them in the end to have that product or develop. There's something for them in the end. Like, they wouldn't go into that just on a philanthropy approach, right? It's something they can take that project and bring it into their core suite of whatever they're working on.
Look, one thing you were talking about, Darlene, is the benefits around, you know, using open source. And I definitely think if you're a company, you can use and you can get it right where you can sort of keep some commercial value with the company. I mean, definitely you can use it as a way to gain market share, to train, to get a whole bunch of developers and or users trained up on how the product is used, you know, and all that kind of stuff is very important for adoption, especially in the business world. You know, they want to know there is support available. They want to know that their users know how to use and familiar with this kind of product. You know, so I think it definitely is a way that you can propel your business. Like, if you take Asterix, for example, you know, Asterix had been a closed source system. It would never be as widely successful as it is today. So those guys used open source cleverly in their business model.
And actually, what I wanted to say, though, Mark, was that even though we layer on top of an open source product and we do have closed source code, our employees contribute back to the community at large. For an example, one of my coworkers, he spends a lot of time developing printer drivers for the CUPS project for a wide range of printers, because I know that our struggle is that, you know, outside the HP printer line, there's really limited printer support for Linux. So even though we are using, but we're also contributing back in different manner as well.
Yeah, I think that's a common kind of model, a lot of companies as well, you know, where they contribute. I think that's a big benefit of the social aspect of open source software. You know, everybody contributes back to making this product better, which then benefits everybody else, you know. So that's I think a lot of guys do it that way. I mean, we do as well, even if it's just us contributing in terms of bug reports, small patches and bug fixes and that kind of stuff, a lot of open source projects. And, you know, just to sort of say as well, it's not like, I mean, although we talk mainly about open source projects, big corporate backers behind them, there are another model for open source. It's just a purely community-driven model, such as Joomla or Drupal. I mean, those projects basically driven by large communities of users behind them. And essentially, the way those models work is that the people contributing to the project make money by selling services on top of that. And that's probably one of the best sustainable models out there, because there's thousands of guys making money out of it. There's, you know, a couple of hundred developers contributing back. So you're not under threat of, you know, let's say you had PeopleSoft in your company and they got bought up by Oracle and you're forced now to move over to the Oracle stack. Or, you know, if you're a company, like, let's say, you know, Sun's been bought by Oracle now, we're all left wondering what's going to happen to Java, you know, what's going to happen to VirtualBox, what's going to happen to MySQL. Okay, I mean, because it's open source, you can at least take that code base and you can start a community project around it, which is one of the benefits of open source. But, you know, you're still left sort of with a lot of uncertainty and doubt around those things. So I think, you know, that is one model that it does work as well.
All right, well, I think that's about all I have to contribute today, Mark. What about you?
Yeah, I think, you know, that's all I have. I was trying to sort of think if I've got anything else to add, because it's quite a broad topic. You know, there's a lot to discuss and a lot to talk about. Mm-hmm. It's one of those things which, you know, you can sit with your mates at the bar and chat about for hours. You know, and as you talk, you sort of discover more things to think about and to consider and how you can, you know, use this in your business model. But, yeah,
I also... Sorry, Mark. I just also, you know, I was just thinking about the fellows at Canonical, you know, because if they're so, you know, some of them are pretty hardcore in the open source community, but yet, you know, they provide an external sort, you know, external revenue stream for Ubuntu, right, through Canonical. And, you know, I think that's a good example of maybe how you can, you know, survive in an open source model.
Yeah, personally, I'm not sure whether Canonical is a great example, because I think they're struggling to make money. And if it wasn't for the philanthropic endeavors of Mark Shuttleworth, I think they'd have been out of business a while ago. Yeah, and basically, that's a classic case. They're struggling to find a way to make money out of the open source model. You know, and eventually, they're going to have to go the way of Red Hat, where they keep something behind. Or maybe they'll come up with an innovative, you know, solution, talking with the hardware vendors, you know, around bundling it with the laptops or the desktops that come out and all of that, especially around these netbooks, you know. Potentially there can be revenue around that. But yeah, it is, you know, for me, every time I hear about Canonical's financial situation and they say they're breaking even, you know, if you were looking at it purely from a business point of view, I don't think it would be worth the investment, you know, if you're just going to, as I say, look at it from a profit percentage point of view. So yeah, let's Canonical be great to see how they evolve and see if they can also help us evolve our understanding of open source business models.
Mm-hmm. Because I know they really promote the training side of what they do as well. Because I was looking at some certification on Ubuntu, and yeah, they were very aggressive in the marketing of the training solutions that they provide.
Yeah, I think that's a traditional kind of approach to get the training thing, you know. And what I think is key with all of this, okay, is that the companies that sponsor these projects build up enough of a brand name and brand image that people find it worthwhile to buy services from them, rather than say coming to, you know, to my company and say, oh look, we don't want to go to Red Hat and pay them a subscription. We'd rather use CentOS and, you know, phone you whenever there's a problem. And due to the stability of Linux, you hardly ever get phoned. But you know, that's the sort of, you know, the issue that you have to deal with. So yeah, I think one of the key things, I suppose, around open source is to also build your brand and build your, you know, brand recognition around your product, so people come to you rather than just going anywhere else to get support for that project or product that they're using.
And I think, you know, I know I talk about Ubuntu lots, but I did also discuss Fedora, but you can tell which flavor that I've worked with and I prefer. But I know with Ubuntu, like, just the way they make it so much easier for non-techie, non-Linux people that aren't immersed in open source to install their product. You know, it's with a CD. You don't have to compile anything. It's, you know, it does all the partitioning of your hard drive for you and everything, you know, and it's just a much easier way to get introduced to the product and to start to learn it. So, again, they're grabbing mindshare there, right? And they work with third-party vendors, you know, like our stuff is in their repository. It makes it much easier for us to promote it as well.
Yeah, I think that, you know, they're really quite smart around using open source in terms of getting the whole mindshare. I mean, they basically came from zero to dominate the whole Linux distribution market, you know, within a short space of time, providing all those things which you've mentioned. But, you know, I think in conclusion for me, you know, if you're going to have a run a business based on open source and it's not just something which is providing support of third-party, you know, products and services, and by that I mean, like, you know, you could be people can provide support for Microsoft Exchange. They don't owe Microsoft Exchange any money or Microsoft any money, but Microsoft makes money by selling Exchange. So, you know, I'm talking about the companies that will be behind the actual products themselves. You have to have something of value that you retain back. And I think that's what you need to always do when you start a business. You decide to open source your core software product. It's like, okay, what is it of value that we have? Whether it's your brand name, your support network, you know, it might be something like your ability to distribute or handle calls, you know, support calls 24 hours a day and provide, you know, response times that are immediate and all that kind of stuff, you know. So you've got to build something core that you have. And I suppose it's the same thing with any business, really. You know, what is your competitive advantage over others in the marketplace? And I think that's what people have to consider when they open source their products.
All right, Mark. So in conclusion, I also have to agree with you about holding back a part of your core services because, again, from a North American point of view, business is there to, you know, break even. You know, like I know even know with our tax, you know, with Revenue Canada, if they see you only breaking even or not making any profit in 5 years, then they start to question the validity of your business approach. So... And, you know, how long can you be in philanthropy versus business, right? So I agree that with the open source, there's many benefits. Like, I think the ring benefits around that core product can be realized for the open source community. And just, you know, we are in a new age of business development these days with the economic crunch and having to look at maybe the traditional business model isn't all that it's cracked up to be.
Yeah, I'd agree. Until the rules of the game change, and maybe, you know, given the current economic crisis, they might change. Yeah, but until people consider things other than just the profit motive in business, yeah, as, you know, as you say, you need to make money to survive and continue to actually fund and produce the project. So, I mean, if you want further development on it and you want it to move ahead, you actually need to make money out of it. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, thanks, Darlene, for joining me. I think that's a wrap. I'm not quite sure what our next episode will be, but I'm sure we'll think of something. And we'd just like to thank all our listeners for listening to another episode. Thanks very much. Bye.
Thank you for listening to Hack Republic Radio. HPR is sponsored by Caro.net, so head on over to caro.net for all your hosting needs.